Good evening, everyone. I'd like to welcome you to the Rebecca Mitchell Taramoto Short Fiction Award celebration. And this evening is a special one to all of us who work at Blackbird because the way that we choose the story from among those that have been published in Blackbird previously, every year we also pair the award winner reading with a reading by an established master of short fiction. And to introduce that person, Clint McCown.
Those writers of fiction who dedicate themselves solely to the short story are few and far between, especially in this day and age when agents think of short story collections as nothing but warm-ups for the real moneymakers, those 600-page beach reads. But real literature has always been alive and well in the short story form. In writing about Chekhov, critic James Lasdom wrote that Chekhov's art was engaged in the renouncing of artifice, that Chekhov was concerned with, quote, facing us for the first time with a reflection of ourselves in our unadorned ordinariness, as well as our unfathomable strangeness. Ordinariness coupled to strangeness. That's an apt description of Chekhov's story, also of Raymond Carver's stories, and also of David Jouse's. The measure of one's success in the field of short fiction is not measured in royalty checks like it is in blockbuster novels. Those who focus on the short story form have to hope for other external indicators of greatness. A career might be validated, for example, by the author's being awarded an NEA grant, or by winning a big prize like the AWP Award for Short Fiction, or by having one's work included in the Best American Short Stories collection, or maybe the O. Henry Prize collection. Or maybe the writer might win a pushcart prize or two. Maybe the writer could win a prestigious appointment like the James A. Michener Fellowship from the Copernicus Society of America. Or maybe a writer might become prominent enough to get a craft book published because others want to learn how to do what that writer does so well. Any of those things could establish a short fiction writer as a worthy practitioner of the art. Accomplishing all of them would be virtually unheard of. But of course, that's exactly what David Jouse has done. In the national writing community, I know of no one who has earned greater respect from his peers. A couple of weeks ago, I was at a writer's conference, and I happened to have a chat with the publisher of Dave's most recent collections, and the publisher told me this story. He said that when he agreed to bring out the new and selected edition of Dave's stories, Dave sent him a huge pile of his work, knowing that the publisher would sort through them all and pick the ones he deemed worthy of the collection. The publisher handed that chore over to a trusted editor with the instruction to weed out the weaker half. The editor read the stories with his most critical eye and came back to the publisher and said, "We have a big problem." "What problem?" the publisher asked. "There's nothing here to weed out," the editor told him. "It's all great work." So they decided there was only one thing to do. They accepted it all and published Dave's new and selected stories as a two-volume set. The first is called Glossolalia, the second is called Nice People, and both of those are for sale out there this evening. Now, that sort of thing is virtually unheard of in the publishing world. I have heard Dave read many times over the years, and I always leave his readings with a sense of disappointment. I'm always disappointed that more of my friends weren't there to hear him. Tonight we can all count ourselves among the fortunate. So please help me welcome David Joss.
Thank you very much, Clint. I want to thank everybody who's treated me with such great hospitality here, David Wojahn, Clint McCown, Linda Flynn. It's been a real pleasure to be here. And I got a chance to talk with some of Clint's students, but I guess I didn't scare them all away. I see a couple of faces out there in his class this afternoon. And one of the stories we talked about is one that is a bit of an unusual story, and I thought I would start off with that. It's also a quite short story. And I'll tell you a little bit about how it got started. People tend to like these sort of origin stories. I had a neighbor who retired and became a fanatical birder. And he one day invited me into his house. This was about a week or two after he had been diagnosed with stage 4 cancer, to show me his life list. Life list for birders is a list of all the birds they've seen in their life. And it was a long and impressive list. But because of the way my mind works, probably was dropped on my head many times as a child, I immediately thought of a death list, all the birds that he hasn't seen. And I started to think about all the things all of us don't even notice. And I'm famous for not noticing things. So I tried to see if I could tell a story by focusing not on what the characters are aware of, but what they aren't aware of. So it's just a brief little story. It's in 7 sections. It has 4 points of view, one of which is from a bird, since the character was a birder, the person who started it was a birder. And each of the sections is headed with the name of the character whose point of view is reflected in that section. So it's called What They Didn't Notice. When Frank stepped out of the doctor's office, he didn't notice the sky. If he had been 60 years younger, perhaps he would have noticed that one of the clouds scudding up from the southwest looked like an enormous white horse. Its long neck was outstretched, as if straining toward a finish line, but it had no legs. Still, its mane and tail were flying. Nor did he notice the ground. The soil in the flower beds that flanked the sidewalk was unnaturally black for this part of the country, imported, no doubt, from some northern state. Had he noticed the dirt, he might have thought about the clay that lay beneath it, damp and tinged with red, as if so many animals had died here for so many centuries that their blood could not be completely rained away. In a nearby tulip poplar, a gray-green bird with a yellow breast sang over and over a deep-throated song, fracturing its melody each time with 4 or 5 abrupt, awkward pauses. But Frank did not see or hear it. If it had been another day or another place, he probably would have noticed the mask around its eyes, like a raccoon's, only yellow, and recognized the bird as a yellow-throated vireo. Though he'd been an ardent bird watcher since the year before he retired, it was a species he had never seen before, one he could have added to his life list. But he did not see it, so it would have to remain on that larger list of things that were part of the world's life, but not his own. And when he reached the parking lot, he didn't notice how long he stood there beside his car, holding the key in his hand. He did not notice his hand either, how it looked like his father's, liver-spotted, the knuckles gnarled with arthritis. It had been 30 years since he'd seen his father's hands crossed upon the black lapels of his last suit. If he had noticed, perhaps his hand would have started to tremble. But it didn't. It was still, like a small animal that freezes where it stands, hoping it hasn't been seen. He stood there for nearly 2 minutes, a full minute longer than it took for the doctor to change his life. Ellie. When Frank left the house that morning, Ellie didn't notice how his voice quavered when he told her he was going to meet a couple of his friends for coffee. And when he came home, she did not notice how quietly he closed the door, as if he didn't want to wake someone who was sleeping. The doctor. The doctor did not notice, one, the way the carotid artery in Frank's throat pulsed while he listened to the biopsy results. Two, the squeak of his nurse's shoes as she walked past the closed door. Three, the way he kept clearing his throat as if hinting that Frank should say something now, anything, whatever he was thinking or feeling. Four, the fact that he nodded as he spoke, as if he were secretly agreeing with Frank's silence. Five, the fact that he kept repeating the word options. Six, a bird song outside the window. Seven, the telephone ringing at the nurse's station and Loretta's bored voice saying, "I'm sorry, he's with a patient right now." Eight, his hand lightly shaking Frank's shoulder as if to wake him. Nine, the coppery taste of fear on the back of his tongue. The vireo. The vireo did not notice the man passing below him on the sidewalk. It was also unaware of the obsessive repetition of its song, or even of the fact that it was singing. Least of all was it aware that this day could be unlike any other, or even that there were such things as days, as time, as death. Ellie. That night, after they made love for the first time in weeks, Ellie did not notice Frank sobbing silently. And when, finally, his voice shaking, he told her what the doctor had said, she was not aware that the fingers of her left hand curled up slowly, like an animal dying, while her right hand stroked the back of his neck, the stubble left there by the barber. Frank. After he told her, Frank looked at his wife's face in the dim light the moon cast through their window, but he did not see it, not really. He was seeing her face as it was 45 years before, when they first met, and he was wondering where that young girl had gone, and where he had gone, the young man he was then, tall and thin and so strong from lifting hay bales that she couldn't stop touching his arms, his shoulders. Because he was thinking these thoughts, he did not notice the anger that tinged her voice when she asked him why he hadn't told her about his symptoms or his trips to the doctor. Nor did he dare notice that he was angry too, offended even, that she would go on living without him. The vireo. By the time first Frank and then Ellie finally fell asleep, the vireo had been sleeping for hours, its feathers fluffed against the cold and its head tucked under its wing. Torn clouds were streaking overhead, scarring the moon, and a wind was stirring the leaves that surrounded its nest. But the bird was oblivious. It noticed nothing, nothing at all. And in the morning, when it would wake, it would begin to live once again the one day of its life, singing its beautiful, broken song. That's that one. I'm trying to corner the market on the OA audience. You all know about YA. Well, I'm going for the old adult audience. I know I look as young as Adam, but you know, it's, looks are misleading. So this is another story about some oldsters. And this started when I made a visit to my hometown and I went to a restaurant there. And there was an old man dressed up in this well-worn, dingy brown suit, white shirt, buttoned to the collar, and no tie. And the waitresses were very solicitous of him. And when he left, they all started to say, oh, he's going to feel so bad when he gets home tonight and finds out that he doesn't have his tie on. And then I found out that where he was going was to the local nursing home to see his wife, who was dying of pancreatic cancer. So I tried many drafts of this story from his point of view before I finally came to the conclusion that it was actually the wife's point of view. It's called Tell Me Something. She had been dying for nearly 2 months now, and each day he sat beside her bed in the nursing home and told her how much he loved her. At first she had liked hearing him say that after all these years of silence on the subject, but now she didn't think she could bear to hear him say it one more time. And she dreaded almost as much hearing the daily gossip, what the waitress at Tubby's Cafe told him about that new minister over at the Presbyterian Church, the one who quoted movies during his sermons, what everybody was saying about the city council's plan to put a second stoplight on the highway going through town, what that swindler Harlan Jensen was asking for his worthless farm. She'd even stopped looking forward to the latest news from the children. They still called them the children, though Susie and Ralph had children and even grandchildren of their own now. One or the other called him almost every night after he came home from the nursing home to see how she was doing. They called her, too, from time to time. For some reason, she couldn't think of anything to say to them, and so there were long, uncomfortable silences. She knew it was only a matter of weeks, maybe days, before she would be moved across the street to the hospital, and they would leave their homes in Atlanta and Pittsburgh and fly to her bedside to say their final goodbyes. She looked forward to seeing them, as she looked forward to seeing her husband each morning when he entered her room with his rumpled, out-of-date fedora in his big hands and that sad, thin smile on his face. But she also dreaded their visit. The last time they came to see her, in April, right after they found the cancer in her pancreas, they'd started talking about soccer, of all things, this foreign sport her great-grandchildren were playing. And she'd instantly felt as though she were already dead and gone out of their lives. They went on and on until she decided to pretend she'd fallen asleep. It was a relief when they tiptoed out of the room and went down the hall to the community room to talk. She hated to admit it, but the worst thing about dying wasn't the pain, though every time it reared up, it seared her insides with a throbbing fire, but the boredom. She almost had the laugh when she thought of the phrase, bored to death. How many times had she said that? But only now did she have any idea how true it was. She loved her husband, always had, even after he betrayed her with that terrible woman who used to hang around at the bowling alley and drink with the men who were too old or lame to go to the war. But she was more bored with him than with anyone or anything. Each night she prayed to die without him finding out how tired she was of him and his face and his voice and all of his irritating habits. So this morning, before he had even finished hanging his hat on the end of her bed, before he could kiss her forehead, before he could start in with his how did you sleep or his how's my sweetheart this morning, she said, tell me something, Henry. Tell me something you've never told me before. He clicked his dentures then, as he often did when he was nervous or worried. The sound made her grit her own teeth. What do you mean? She shifted in her bed, trying to take the pressure off the bed sore that was starting on her hip. I mean, something you've kept from me, something secret, something that matters. He sat down in the plaid armchair next to her bed. He was wearing the same wrinkled brown suit he'd been wearing all week, only this morning he'd forgotten to put on his tie. His dingy white shirt was buttoned to the collar, and she knew he'd be surprised later that night when he went to take off his tie and found it wasn't there. He leaned toward her, his forehead furrowed. Are you feeling all right, Emma? Do you want me to call a nurse? She sighed. I'm feeling fine. In fact, though, she was feeling lightheaded and had been ever since she woke up. Even eating her oatmeal hadn't helped, as it usually did. It only made her nauseated. She looked down at the floor to steady her spinning head. The light that slanted through the window panes cast a pattern of rectangles on the carpet. Looking at them, she thought of playing hopscotch when she was a child. Her hair then had been so blonde that it was almost white, though it had turned brown by the time she started school. And now her hair, the few tufts of it that remained, was white again. Somehow that seemed to mean something. But what? Henry pushed his wire glasses back up his nose and looked at her. You look a little pale, he said. Tell me something, she said, closing her eyes. I don't know what to say. Anything, say anything. Just make it something you've never told me before, not me or anyone else. You're serious? She didn't answer. Silence, she knew, was the best answer. All her life she had used it to make him listen to her. He cleared his throat and clicked his dentures again. She wanted to tell him to please, please, please stop making those noises, but she didn't. She just waited for him to speak. It was during the war, he finally said, and cleared his throat again. She opened her eyes. I don't want to hear about that woman, she said. Tell me something else. No, he said, this doesn't have anything to do with her or any other woman, just you. She lifted her head and looked at him. Were there other women? She almost hoped he'd say yes, just so she'd have some other pain to distract her. He shook his head. No, not one, and that's the truth, Emma. She laid her head back down on the warm pillow. Her head seemed to keep on sinking even after it had stopped, as if something inside her brain were spiraling ever downward. Go on, she said, and closed her eyes again. Once more he cleared his throat, and then he started. You were working in town then, at Tubby's, only it was called the Main Street Cafe then, remember? By the time I'd finished the morning chores, you'd have already taken the kids to school and gone on to work yourself. I'd come in the kitchen those mornings and make myself a pot of coffee and sit there at the table and I'd... She opened her eyes to see why he'd stopped. He was rubbing his forehead with a finger and thumb. I don't know why I'm telling you this, he said. Because I asked you to, she said, and was immediately embarrassed. She'd said it like a young girl, a coquette, sure of the power of her charms. No, he said. What I mean is I could tell you anything. I don't know why I picked this. Just tell me. Okay, he sighed and clicked his dentures. I'd be sitting there in the kitchen thinking about everything I had to do that day. Bed the barn, mend fence posts, shovel grain in the silo, all that. And then I'd start thinking about you and wondering what you were doing down there at the cafe. I'd imagine you talking to customers, bringing them platters of bacon and eggs and French toast. And I'd wonder what you were thinking about while you talked to them, if it was me or the kids, or if you just forgot about all of us while you were there, away from us and the farm. And I'd wonder if you liked being at work more than at home. Henry, she said, in the voice she'd always used to calm the children. Sometimes I was sure you were happier there. I believed you'd have left me if it weren't for the kids. We were having trouble then, you remember. That was a few months after, well, you know. He couldn't say any more. He didn't have to. I forgave you, she said. You know that. I know, he said, but that's not the point. She wanted to ask what the point was, but just then a pain flared in her side, and she had to clench her fingers and curl her toes for a few seconds until it was gone. Are you all right, he asked, his big warm hand on hers. She nodded, and her head felt loose, as if it might roll off. He stood up abruptly and paced to the end of the room. And now here you are. He looked around the room, his watery blue eyes scanning the blown roses on the wallpaper, the family portrait hanging over the blonde mahogany dresser, the bedside tray with its overturned cellophane-wrapped water glass and its styrofoam pitcher. Here, he shook his head, before me, I should have been the first. He turned his back to her, and she watched his shoulders work. She said, dear, don't think like that. It wasn't supposed to be this way, he said. You'll be fine when I'm gone, she assured him. You have your friends. The children will visit a lot, and you can go see them, spend time with all the grandkids and their children. No, he said, nothing else. Don't say that, she said, and tried to raise herself up onto her elbows. But the pain spun up from her side into her head, and she fell back. Somehow, the fall seemed to take a long time, or to happen over and over. She wasn't sure which. He took a deep breath. Then, his back still to her, he continued. One morning, I started out to the barn, but I just couldn't bring myself to go in. I stood there for a long time, just thinking, and then I got into the pickup and drove into town. First, I went by the school, hoping I'd see the kids out on the playground for recess, but they weren't there. So I headed downtown and parked a couple of blocks away from the cafe where you wouldn't see the pickup. Then I went into the Rexall across the street and stood in one of the aisles near the front and watched you through the window. You were walking back and forth from the kitchen to the tables, carrying plates and pouring coffee and taking orders, and you were smiling and laughing with everybody. You turned around then and faced her. It had been so long since I'd seen you smile, he said. She cleared her own throat now, and as she did, she wondered if it bothered him the way all of his noises bothered her. She said, "How long did you watch me?" "I don't know. 5 minutes, 10? I'm not sure. But then I got back into the pickup and drove out to the farm. And when you came home that night, I didn't say anything. I wanted to tell you I'd been watching you, but I didn't know how to say it or even why I'd done it. And I didn't know what you'd say, whether you'd be mad or not even care." He paused. "I don't know why, but I've never been able to forget that day. Every now and then I find myself thinking about it. I see you there, walking back and forth behind that plate glass window in your blue and white uniform, a smile on your face, your hair done up the way you wore it then, pinned on top in a bun. And I see myself across the street, hiding, spying on you, like some kind of peeping Tom, and I feel ashamed." He sat on the edge of the bed. Down the hall in one of the rooms, a telephone rang. They listened to it until it stopped. "Why didn't you come into the cafe and talk to me?" she asked then. He looked at his hands. "I didn't want to see that smile leave your face." For a long time, she didn't say anything. She was trying to imagine that morning, trying to look through the cafe window and see her husband in the drugstore across the street, trying to make herself smile at him. She closed her eyes to try and see it better. Then she said, "Thank you." "For what?" Henry asked. "For telling me that story." She opened her eyes. For a second, she was surprised at how old he was. She almost didn't recognize him. He cleared his throat. "I shouldn't have," he said. "I'm glad you did," she answered. "Why do you want me to tell you something like that?" "Because I'm not dead yet, and I was feeling like I was." "Emma," he said, "don't talk like that." She closed her eyes again. "Now I want to tell you something," she said. "You don't have to." "Do you remember the day we first met?" she asked. He hesitated a moment, then clicked his dentures. The sound made her think of a Geiger counter, the way it clicked whenever it came near something radioactive, and she laughed a little. After all the treatment she'd had, she probably was radioactive by now. He looked at her. "What's funny?" he said. "Nothing," she answered. "Everything." Then she said, "You don't remember, do you?" He took a breath, then said, "It was so long ago." She laughed again. "I don't remember that day either. I wish I could. I was someone else then. I had another life ahead of me. What, I don't know or care, but another life just the same. And then we met and everything changed, and I can't remember that day. Where we were, what the weather was like, what we were wearing, what we talked about. It seems so important that I remember it, but I can't. Day after day, I've lain here and tried to remember, but I can't." He took her hand. "It doesn't matter," he said. "That was 60 years ago, a lifetime ago." "A lifetime," she said. He clicked his dentures once again. She wanted to tell him to stop it, but instead she smiled. "Emma," he said, squeezing her hand, "I love you, sweetheart." "I know," she answered. A pain was coming now, a big one, she could tell. She could feel it rising in her like a wave about to shatter itself against rocks, but she made herself keep on smiling until he finally smiled back. That's all, thanks.
Good evening, everybody. For those of you who don't know, I'm Victoria Flanagan, and tonight I have the privilege of introducing Adam Latham, winner of the 2017 Rebecca Mitchell Terremoto Short Fiction Prize. The Terremoto Short Fiction Prize is sponsored by the family of Rebecca Mitchell Terremoto and is awarded in her memory, honoring her devotion to writing fiction, particularly the short story, and to encourage literary excellence among writers early in their careers. The prize is awarded every other year to the best work of short fiction published in Blackbird, but with particular emphasis, again, on work by an emerging writer. Through a selection process that involved all of us on staff at the journal, interns, associate editors, and senior editors, we honor tonight Adam's story, The Lizard Man, originally published in Blackbird's fall 2016 issue. I had the pleasure of serving as lead associate editor of Blackbird when we published Adam's story, and as all of those who've read it, no, it's one that sticks with you. A lore-fueled back-road monologue, out of Lee County, South Carolina. The Lizard Man is a story of searching, be it the hunt for the titular cryptid through Carolina swamps or the pursuit of solace among the mire of grief. With remarkable, clear-eyed concision, the Lizard Man enacts, though it never quite trusts, its opening assertions, and I'm quoting here, "I am both skeptic and believer. Story invented, punishment averted." With remarkable narrative economy, the story forces us to consider what makes our local monsters and what makes monsters out of us. But in Latham's Lee County, allegory only gets us so far. Lore rubs up against lore, proving that tall tales get taller, truer somehow, the more they're repeated. Eventually, as Latham's story proves, we become part of our own myths. We embody the legends that we stoke. Adam Latham studied at the University of the South and NYU, and his stories have appeared in Blackbird and Mississippi Review. He lives on a small farm beside the Cumberland Plateau, and he works for the Suwannee Writers Conference. Everyone, please join me in welcoming Adam Latham.
Hi, everyone. Thank you, Victoria. That was wonderful. When Mary called me to let me know that I'd been given this award, thank you, Mary, I was absolutely shocked. I'm very grateful to the Terremotos for supporting writers and short fiction and allowing a writer like myself to come here and read with a writer like David, whose work I greatly admire and is a master of the form. Thank you, VCU and Blackbird. I've had the pleasure, I'm in my job working at Suwannee, to get to know so many fine writers and editors that have come through this program. Y'all do an amazing job. And I'm just very grateful to be here tonight, and it means a lot to me. So thank you very much. I'm going to read The Lizard Man, of course, and here we go. I'm from Lee County, South Carolina, Bishopville, home of the Lizard Man. On June 29th, 1988, a local boy, 17 at the time, blew a tire driving home late from work. He just finished changing it beside Skate Poor Swamp when a tall, slathering creature lunged out of the woods. The boy dove into his car and locked the doors. He fumbled with his keys as reptilian fingers ripped at the driver's side handle. The scaly creature leapt onto the roof and clawed at his windshield. Swerving at high speed, the boy threw the cryptid from his car. I love this story because the kid survived. I'm both skeptic and believer. This incident screams teenager driving late, possible drinking involved, wrecked car, doesn't want to get in trouble, story invented, punishment averted. What's interesting is how the event escalated. The boy's father believed his shaken son and filed a report with the police. I would have told my son to tell the truth, but my boy never made it to 17. After the Lizard Man sighting, other incidents of car vandalism were reported around Skate Poor Swamp. The Lizard Man made our small town exciting. It put us on the map. Before the Lizard Man, and mostly after, there wasn't much to do. Wendy was 15 when we began to date, my dark Carolina girl. I courted her through high school. We walked fields at night. We held hands and pointed our flashlights into the woods. We searched for the Lizard Man. We tore off each other's flannel shirts and jeans in a clearing beside the swamp. Her back arched over pine needles. I have a theory about the Lizard Man. I don't think he's a man at all. I think the Lizard Man is a woman. Female cryptids scare me far worse. My dad took me to a turkey shoot when I was a kid. Players shoot shotguns at paper plates pinned to hay bales. The shooter with the most plate holes wins, traditionally a turkey, but usually there's just a cooler of the six packs or frozen chickens. Take your pick. A grizzled hunter sat on a tailgate, coverall suspenders unclipped, gut hanging out. He asked me if I knew how Skate Poor Swamp got its name. Escape over, I said. Like you get over it? It comes from the Revolutionary War, he said. A whore was tailing around after a British company. The officer threatened to hang her, and she escaped into the swamp. Skate Poor Swamp. I pictured the woman in a thin dress splashing through the swamp, briar torn, hounds chasing her. Maybe she didn't escape. Maybe hounds ripped her apart Maybe an alligator dragged her underwater and stuffed her corpse under a bank to eat later. I'm not saying the whore became the lizard man, although that's certainly possible. What's more likely, and this phenomenon is well documented, is that a tragic event spawned a dark aura that later manifested as a creature, cryptid. Even disbelievers will admit that after a truly horrible thing happens, there's a bad vibe around a place. Take Wendigos, a giant bipedal cryptid from the North Woods with glowing eyes, matted hair, yellow fangs, and a long tongue. A Wendigo is created when a person resorts to cannibalism to survive. Translated from Cree, Wendigo means evil that devours. Like Sasquatch, they have a notorious foul odor. Wendigos crave human flesh and grow in proportion to what they eat. Gluttony only increases their emaciated hunger. Wendy and I had been married for 6 years. We were on a hot streak chasing monsters. We snowshoed down logging trails in Wisconsin over fresh powder, packs loaded with gear. The silence when we stopped to rest made us feel uneasy. Unlike Bigfoot hunts, which you prepare for by drinking concentrated lemon juice for 3 weeks to rid yourself of body odor, with Wendigos, you want them to smell you. Wendy and I ate steak, 2 meals per day, 10 days straight. Meat exuded from our pores. We set up a perimeter in the snow with strategically placed speakers and played a continuous loop of our son, Chad. I lifted the audio track from a video I recorded when he was 4, a summer picnic at a state park in South Carolina. Chad swam in the shallows of a spring-fed lake. "Marco," he said, "Marco." His eyes closed as we giggled, not answering. The words didn't really matter. You could hear his bleating, a child calling for his parents. I imagine Wendy and me back then, on the bank in Carolina, fading, disappearing as the sun set over Cypress and Chad splashed, crying out for us. In the swamp, the lizard man opened its red eyes. Wendy had agreed the recording was perfect for luring in the Wendigo. We hid in the pines and played the track on loop, 4 hours of listening to our son asking where we were. The temperature dropped. Our breath fogged and we turned our headlamps off. The air changed, the atmosphere, my blood. I crouched in the snow beside Wendy, my heart thrashing. Chad bleated. "Marco, Marco." Something circled us. I grabbed Wendy as she tried to pull away toward what was out there. My body heat rose as I pinned her down. I smelled the Wendigo's rotten decay. "Shh," I said, "shh," as the loop played. I sensed the Wendigo towering over us, ribs rising and falling as it smelled us, our skin, our sweat, our fear, licking its fangs with its long tongue, ready to consume us, and would have, too, had Wendy not screamed, "Come get us. Come get us, you giant stinking bastard." She sobbed, and I whispered in her ear, as if calling her back. My son's 5th Christmas. You've never seen a boy so happy. He was a smaller version of myself, only better. Perfect. The four-wheeler shined in the garage. Wendy said we couldn't afford it, the Chad was too young. The grass sparkled, everything encased in ice. "Get your shoes and jacket," I said, and cranked the four-wheeler. I shifted into reverse and backed out of the garage. Cold sliced through my undershirt. "Get your helmet," Wendy said from the steps. "Let Dad ride with you." "Ah," Chad said, "come on." I snapped on his helmet, adjusted the straps, and lifted him onto the four-wheeler. I placed his hands on the handles and showed him how to squeeze the brakes and give it gas with his right thumb. "I'll teach you how to change gears later," I said. "Take her out. Easy." Chad crept around the yard, my prints in the glistening Jack Frost. I was already thinking about the rifle rack I'd install in a few years. He drove in 3 slow circles. I turned to Wendy, standing in her new silk robe, arms crossed. "See," I said, "he's doing fine." Her voice cut the air. I spun around to see my son, emboldened, heading toward the steep slope that's angled sharply to the road. "Chad," I shouted. If I had let him continue at his own determined pace, he might have been just fine, just had a little scare, but I startled him. He gunned the gas, and the four-wheeler leapt into the air. 500 pounds tumbled back. I lifted the four-wheeler off my son. Blood spilled from his mouth like he had thrown up cherry syrup. For a second, I thought that's all it was. He stared at me, pale, shaking. The ambulance pulled in, sirens, lights flashing in our driveway. We sped to the hospital where the doctor in the ER pronounced my world dead. He gave us Xanax to ease the shock. I handed my pills to Wendy. She took hers and pocketed mine. Maybe I hoped the drugs would take the edge off her bitterness, the anger that would inevitably harden against me as grief set in. Back home, wrapped in a blanket, hair tangled and silent, she locked herself in her bedroom. By spring, I lived with a ghost. Wendy had turned gaunt. Bags bloomed beneath her eyes. Her hair fell out. On rare occasions when we went out, people stared at her. They thought she was on meth. I could see it in her eyes. What a shame. She could be so pretty. They glared at me. I wanted to shout at them that it wasn't my fault. I focused on Wendy instead. I opened doors for her and cooked meals she barely ate. More than anything, I became very quiet. Unable to sleep, I walked country roads at night. I wandered with a flashlight, first just to get out of the house, but gradually my thoughts turned to the lizard man lunging out of the swamp after that boy. I read old newspapers. I collected things, not cheap memorabilia either, but real artifacts. Glass from a window the lizard man had smashed, a broken antenna from a mangled car, a photograph of a field in the woods, a slouched figure too tall to be a man. I documented findings on our dining table and stored them in plastic bins. I found news clippings and pictures in different orders than I'd left them. I didn't say anything to Wendy, but I could feel her slowly coming back to me. When I laced my boots one evening, heading out for another walk, it was everything I could do not to hug her when haggard and hollow-eyed she pulled on a baggy sweater to join me. We didn't talk that first night. The next week, we shined our lights into the woods, into thickets, through Spanish moss and cane brakes, searching for the lizard man. We stumbled through our days exhausted, but at night, we lived. We hunted. One night, Wendy steered our walk back to the clearing where we had first made love. She attacked me there. She tore my pants down and pulled me on top of her. She clawed me as I entered her. "Fuck me," she said. "Fuck me harder, you fucking goddamn lizard man." I understood. She was never going to forgive me. Wendy organized the first lizard man hunt. She placed an ad in the newspaper, bringing her own flashlight. She stood in the bed of a pickup truck, speaking before the event started. In the dusky light, she looked like the woman I married. "Would it be possible," a bearded man in a camo beret asked, "for the lizard man to breed with other cryptids, a skunk ape, perhaps?" "Cats don't breed with dogs," Wendy said. "Every cryptid is the result of unique environmental circumstances. Let's take our subject seriously. There are monsters, and they walk among us. Trust me." "I know." The lizard man mated me. Or I should say, tried to. I didn't get pregnant, so no, crossbreeding is not possible. After the hunt started, I wandered into a thicket, furious with it, Wendy, deeply stung, like she had denied us, Chad, what had happened. Moonlight filtered through magnolias, glinted off Spanish moss. Voices murmured in the fog. It felt like they were hunting me. The next morning, Wendy sat on the couch, eyes bloodshot, holding a cup of coffee. She hadn't slept. "If we are going to do this," she said, "we are going all in." We sold our house. I bought a Dodge Ram 4x4 and a camper trailer. We purchased professional equipment, night vision cameras, wireless speakers, sonic listening devices. We traveled, investigating cryptids. Wendy had taken a special interest in La Lechuza, a witch bird that inhabits the Southwest. Giant, red-eyed owls that summon bad weather and mimic voices to draw prey closer. The choosers are women who have returned from the grave to seek revenge. Wendy called an outfitter in New Mexico to inquire about an area where we suspected high levels of Lechuza activity. "Have you heard of any unusual reports in the Sangre de Cristo Mountains?" Wendy said on speakerphone. "I'm not sure what you mean," the man said. "We're investigating La Lechuza, a witch owl known to be..." "I know what a Lechuza is, lady," the man said. "I've hiked those mountains my entire life and never seen any Lechuza. Bigfoot either. But there's still a chance," Wendy said, "that there could be something out there." "You're batshit crazy," the man said, and hung up. Wendy continued speaking over the dial tone. She got down on the camper floor on her back and explained in a trance-like state. La Lechuza hunts the night, a malicious witch owl on silent wings in search of prey. She cupped her hands, placed them to her lips, and blew a haunting call. Standing over her, it looked like she was not only calling in the witch spirit, but offering herself as prey. We hiked into a remote canyon in the Sangre de Cristo Mountains. It was hot, despite a thunderstorm that had ripped through that morning, dumping rain. We climbed switchbacks into mountains up through ponderosa pine and aspen. We bushwhacked across a ridge and descended into a separate canyon, then dropped our packs in a spruce clearing 30 yards from a swollen creek that plunged into the gorge, smashing through boulders. We secured our perimeter with motion cameras and wireless speakers. After sunset, we made final adjustments in the dim light of our headlamps. Then I pressed play. Eerie calls permeated the night, rising over the steady rush of the creek, a new track that I had engineered. Chad calling. Mom. Simple, efficient, a child asking for his mother. I set up the camera on a tripod, then sat down beside Wendy on the foam pad. She pulled a blanket over us and rested her head on my shoulder. We held each other's hands, her fingers curled around mine, and listened. Not once, not even on those first nights walking by myself after we had lost our son, had I ever felt nothing, zero, not one hair raised. I was upset, deeply disturbed that Chad's voice hadn't worked. Dense fog settled in. At dawn, my legs painfully numb from sitting still all night, I slowly packed equipment. I turned off the camera. The backup battery flashed in its final bar. Wendy stretched. She cupped her hands to her mouth. I thought to warm them, but she blew an alcohol. Perfect. Haunting. I cut the audio recording of Chad. The speakers popped. Then, inexplicably, we heard it. Mom. Clear. Undeniable. Our eyes shot to each other. Hearts stopped at the mimic voice. We heard it once more, a deeper mom from across the creek, what Chad might have sounded like a few years older if he had still been with us. Wendy had already started forward in a motion that somehow seemed both slow and quicker than I'd anticipated. It's an echo, I said, tripping over wires as I tried to stop her. She disappeared into the fog. I slung the equipment, ripping wires free, and stumbled after her. The swollen creek stopped me. It raged, cascading into the canyon. Thick white fog blanketed the far bank. A cold wind rushed up the valley and swept the mist away, only to reveal an empty landscape. Thank you all very, very much. Really appreciate it. Thanks.